Last time we stopped at the end of this passage, looking into this strange thing, trying to build up understanding of four levels as one metaphysical picture, as one holistic vision. Being, knowing, becomes wanting to know, and knowing that it wants to know, and knowing itself as another being. So this gradation from the highest oneness of consciousness and being towards some otherness of self. Now, I will not dwell on it longer. I will go straight into the Vedic vision. So in order to see that picture of, as we saw, triple mind, triple vital, and triple physical, we could look into the Vedic vision, into the Vedic metaphysics. And it is the most interesting thing, because there we will find those answers which are for us now not clear yet. It's not there in the papers. I took it from another article inside this, because it's crucial to see it once. And then all those triple three would be understood. So according to the Veda, there are three earths, three levels of the vital, three vital spaces, trini rajansi. There are three levels of the mind, tisro bhumih, trini rajansi, tisro dyavah. The Veda speaks all the time about these three heavens, three vital spaces, and three earths. They all were projected, as it were, from the triple or three worlds of Svar. Triple Svar. Svar means light, the world of light. They are called Trini Rochanani, or Tri Rochana in Vedic language. And this is the level of the rays of the sun, of the supramental conscious force. Now it is this level which was lost in post-Vedic tradition. The world of Svar was lost, and was understood as the level of illusion, maya, which has to be avoided, and one has to shoot beyond it directly, not going through it, but leaving it behind and going beyond to the absolute. Because of the rays of the light, the level of the rays of the light was lost, the supramental consciousness itself was lost. If the rays are no more true, then the sun is also not true. So in the Vedic vision, this is the scheme. We have it like this. Triple mind, triple vital, and triple physical, which is reflected from the triple Svar, the three levels of Svar, three levels of consciousness. It's like light is covered by light. Yes? The truth is covered by truth. Ritena ritam apihitam dhruvam vam. Thus starts the hymn to Mitra and Varuna. By the truth is covered. So this is the Svar world, where you enter and you see light, but then there is a deeper light, and then there is this still deeper light, And there's a still more unifying level of light. So these levels are there, and as Sri Aurobindo says, for our mind, it's indiscernible. We cannot really discern them, because we are already dazzled by light. The smallest light is making us blind. What to say about those realms of light? So these are the rays, the levels of the rays of the sun, the outburst of the supramental consciousness. Now, supermind itself is described in the Veda as a triple, and there is a triple status of the supermind, as we know it from Sri Aurobindo's reading, which he describes as three levels. The highest level of the supermind is pure unity. Unity dominates everything. There is only oneness of Satchitananda. Then there is a middle part of the supermind, where there is many in one and one in many, completely balanced. And constitute one unity. And that there is the lowest part of the supermind, where many become more dominant than oneness. Though they are still in oneness, but they are already having their own formulation. Now, from this, you can figure out there are three levels, and these three levels are projected into the Svar, which is, again, nothing but these three levels again repeated on another level. You have overmental, gnosis, supramental overmind, as Sri Aurobindo calls it, yes? Overmind gnosis. The first outburst of the sun, it is the surface of the sun, yes? The light which is just now still touching the surface but going out. This is the first movement of the supermind out of itself. Then there is something global, that's what we call overmind, where the light is gathered in groupings, in huge bulks or in huge quantities. Universes are in clusters together. And then there is intuitive mind, where the light becomes more and more individualistic for certain purpose, for a certain flesh, for certain meaning. It is still the same quality, unifying, true light, but it is already projected into manyness, into individual characteristic. Now these three, again, unity and manifoldness on one side, and relation between in the middle, is projected as we would see in the mental, vital, and the physical existence. It's the same law. Mental is more unifying, vital is where this interaction takes place between manifoldness and oneness, and finally physical existence, where everything is shaped according to the individual form. You can see this triple law in the mental mind, vital mind, physical mind. You can see the same triple law in the mental, vital, 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 physical, vital. And in the physical, mental, physical, vital, physical, and physical, physical. Does it make sense? How supermind projects the same law which we all follow. Very simple law. Unity, many in one and one in many, balanced and many. This is Sri Aurobindo's contribution. Now, once you see that, you will understand the whole Pashyanti Vak, Madhyama Vak, and Vaikari Vak, how they work. This is exactly the same law. The law did not change for speech. The speech is nothing but the action of that consciousness. So the mental mind is what Sri Aurobindo calls in Savitri the cosmic or universal mind, illumined mind, yes? The vital mind is the universal life's mind, which he calls in his terminology the higher mind. These are already realms which are beyond us. To reach them is not so easy and simple. It's beyond, on another shore of our existence, beyond our vitality, in a pure mental realm. And then there is mind, physical mind, which is the one which manifests the physicality of the universe. The human mind is also built on the material ground, dependent on the physical brain, dealing with the physical reality of the cosmos. We are the product of the cosmos, and our mind is the product of this mind. But beyond it, there is another mind, and another mind, and deeper and deeper. All these are the three heavens mentioned in Rig Veda, hymn to Savitar, as we know it, Tisra Dyavah of Savitar. The two are in his own realms, in the lap of Savitar, and one is in the realm of Yama, Tisra Dyavah Savitur Dva Upasthan Eka Yamasya Bhuvane Virashat. So it is the mind of the physical universe which is in the world of Yama, and the universal vital mind and the universal mental mind are in the realms of Savitar. Three habits, yes? Pure mind, which is illumined mind, higher mind, which is vital universal mind, and physical mind, mind in this mortal universe, in the universe of change, in the physical universe. Now, if you compare both terminologies, we will see that these three rochanas, supramental over mind, and intuitive mind, three rochana, correspond to Shubindu's terminology of supramental over mind, and intuitive mind. Tisra Dyavah, three heavens, correspond to illumined mind, higher mind, and proper mind. There is an interesting description of Sri Aurobindo of this phenomenon. He describes how these three rochanas, supramental over mind, and intuitive mind, work in terms of over mind. There are different planes of the over mind, he says. Now you can imagine that this triple law governs not only these bigger realities, but also inherent in our own reality, wherever we look. We will see the same law. We will see it in our body, in our constitution of the body, unifying principle, principle of harmony, of unity in diversity and diversity. We always see the three working on all the levels. These three are also on the over-mental level. And he describes it in this way. There are different planes of the over-mind. One is mental, directly creative of the formations that manifest below the lowest level in the mental world, that is over the mental overmind. Above is overmind intuition, and still above are the planes of overmind that are more and more connected with the supermind and have a partially supramental character. Highest in the overmind ranges is the supramental overmind or overmind gnosis. I'm not sure how far you are familiar with Sri Aurobindo's writings, and especially this terminology, but anyhow I'm giving you this because this is a fundamental knowledge. And sooner or later you will have to come to it and see for yourself. So commenting on the hymn of Mitra and Varuna, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the three rochanas in this way. The three luminous worlds in which the triple mental, the triple vital, and the triple physical find the light of their truth and the divine law of their powers. The three luminous worlds in which the triple mental, the triple vital, and the triple physical find the light of their truth and the divine law of their powers. It is on the level of Svar that they find true nature of their own, their true dynamism, the dynamic truth. All of them, physical also. Physical is not different from the supramental. It's a result of the supramental dynamism. And this is the greatest secret. Because physical was neglected in yogic traditions in post-Vedic period. In Vedic period it was seen as a result of that dynamism of the supramind. And that was rediscovered by Sri Aurobindo. Physical is not something which is keeping us away from our freedom. Physical is a manifestation of the divine in its dynamic form. There is a fundamental difference between illumined mind, that is the highest in this heavens, mental mind, and the higher realms of the intuitive mind and over mind. Sri Aurobindo writes about it in the letter, intuition is above illumined mind, which is simply higher, raised to a great luminosity and more open to modified forms of intuition and inspiration. The intuition is the first plane in which there is a real opening to the full possibility of realization. It is through it that one goes farther, first to overmind and then to supermind. What is he saying? He says that illumined mind is simply a higher mind raised even a little higher to receive more intuition, but it is of the same kind. It is still rooted in the inconscient. He also defines the difference between illumined mind and intuitive mind in Savitri, in the canto In the Self of Mind, where intuitive mind can be reached only through the higher action of intuition itself, coming down from above to the illumined mind. We will read a little bit this passage because it's very significant to see the difference between illumined mind perception and the intuition when intuition flashes down. I brought you a picture from Bhutan with all the levels of the, which is very self-explanatory. You can see an interesting thing here. Just have a look. We have planes starting from inconscient, which is dark blue. Then we have red physical. Then we have violet vital. Then we have blue mind. Then we have higher mind, more blue. Then we have illumined mind, even more blue. They are all blue. They are all rooted in the inconscient. And then suddenly, they have a change of color. Intuitive mind. Golden yellow color. And then over mind, which is with all varieties of colors. And then supermind, pure gold. So these three from yellow up, these are three rochanas. And these three blue ones, illumined higher and mind, are three heavens in the Veda. There are also three vital regions, which are not specified here, because it's not needed. There are three physical regions, which are also not specified. And that is that When we go beyond supermind, we can see bliss, consciousness and existence. And then we have unmanifest, something which is beyond anything, avyakta, pure nothingness, embracing all, letting all be, and something beyond it, which Mother calls the Supreme Being, Purushottama. And she draws this picture of the person, that all this impersonal being, universe, has a personality somewhere there, absolutely impossible to define. Now, it's very vivid here, in the self of mind, and if you see the whole second book, how Sri Aurobindo is rising, you will find exactly the same picture in the self of the mind, 13th canto of the second book. You will find the same picture as here. He will rise level after level till he comes to the mental mind, that is the in the self of the mind. Just check for yourself. You will be surprised how content fits to the level after level, plane after plane he is rising. And in the self of mind, he finally reaches the top. At last there came a bare, indifferent sky, where silence listened to the cosmic voice, but answered nothing to a million calls. The soul's endless question met with no response. He stood on a wide arc of summit space, alone with an enormous self of mind which held all life in a corner of its vast, omnipotent, immobile and aloof. In the world which sprang from it, it took no part. It gave no heed to the paeans of victory. It was indifferent to its own defeats. It heard the cry of grief and made no sign. Impartial fell its gaze on evil and good. It saw destruction come and did not move. An equal cause of things, a lonely sea, and master of its multitude of forms, it acted not, but bore all thoughts and deeds. The witness Lord of nature's myriad acts, consenting to the movements of her force. Now I skip a little. All now he seemed to understand and know. Desire came not, nor any gust of will. The great perturbed inquirer lost his task. Nothing was asked, nor wanted any more. There he could stay. The self, the silence won. His soul had peace. It knew the cosmic whole. So this is at the top of the illumined mind. But then suddenly, a luminous finger fell on all things seen or touched or heard or felt, and showed his mind that nothing could be known, that must be reached from which all knowledge comes. The skeptic ray disrupted all that seems and smote at the very roots of thought and sense. In a universe of nescience they have grown, aspiring towards a superconscient sun, playing in shine and rain from heavenlier skies. They never can win, however high they reach, or overpass, however keen they probe. They are all rooted in inconscient. All those thoughts, aspirations of the illumined mind cannot break through. That's why the finger fell from somewhere else, to show. There is more to it. I skip a little. A frail house hanging in uncertain air, the thin ingenious web round which it moves, put out a while on the tree of the universe, and gathered up into itself again, was only a trap to catch life's insect food. Winged thoughts that flutter fragile in brief light, but dead once captured in fixed forms of mind. Aims punny, but looming large in man's small scale. Flickers of imagination's brilliant gauze and cobweb wrapped beliefs alive no more. The magic heart of built-up certitudes made out of glittering dust and bright moonshine in which it shrines its image of the real, collapsed into the nescience whence it rose. Only a gleam was there of simple facts that shroud the mystery lurking in their glow, and falsehoods based on hidden realities by which they live until they fall from time. Our mind is a house haunted by the slain past. Ideas soon mummified, ghosts of old truths, God's spontaneities tied with formal strings and packed into drawers of reason's trim bureau, a grave of great lost opportunities, or an office for misuse of soul and life, and all the waste man makes of heaven's gifts, and all his squanderings of nature's store, a stage for the comedy of ignorance. This is where we live, and this is what we do. In the light of that finger, in the light of that true intuition when it comes. But we believe it was that what Sri Aurobindo said at the beginning. He saw it. It was there. All now he seemed to understand and know. Desire came not, nor any gust of will. The great perturbed inquirer lost his task. Nothing was asked, no wanted anymore. There he could stay. The self, the silence worn. His soul had peace. It knew the cosmic whole. How picture has changed. It's good for us to know that. Change from yellow to blue light. Now, these lower triple realms, mental, vital, 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 and physical, vital, and three physical earths, mental, physical, vital, physical, and physical, physical, three rajans here, the three realms of the vital, are the higher universal life as such, with an entrance to the infinite darkness, because there is a crack in the vital, which separates heaven and earth. And through that crack in us, in that vitality, we have an access to the superconscient ocean and to the inconscient ocean. It is through that crack that those forces come in into our Adhara and try to possess it. And that's why when Sri Aurobindo rises, you remember, to the vital level, to the Godheads of the little life, then next what he experiences is the descent into night. Two dangerous cantos. There will be a gap which he has to cross in order to come to another shore of the vital, and finally to the mind and higher and illumined mind, which ends with canto 13 in the self of the mind. So the mental vital corresponds to the plane which Sri Aurobindo describes in the second book of the Traveler of the Worlds, in the ninth canto, the paradise of the live gods. It's on another shore of the vital, when the darkness was crossed. It's a Vedic metaphysics. You can't find this description anywhere afterwards, only in the Veda. So the three bhumis are the three realms of the universal physical, determined as the mind, which makes it self-conscious in manifesting and maintaining its form, the life, which makes it dynamic in its own movement, physical, and with the proper physical, as the faculty housing all other forces and levels of consciousness taking their part in the material manifestation of the divine. And it is very interesting what Sri Aurobindo says on the physical. In the letter to a sadhak, he writes, "There can be no conquest of other planes by the supermind, but only an influence, so long as the physical is not ready." Because physical is the result of the supramental outcome. And how is it possible to perfect the mind and the vital unless the physical is prepared? And that was the change of all philosophy in the ashram. That's why they concentrated on the physical. They saw that it has limits in preparation in the vital and the mental. For there is such a thing as the mental and vital physical. That's what Sri Aurobindo writes. And mind and vital cannot be said to be perfectly prepared until these are ready. So this scheme which I was giving at the beginning makes more and more sense. This mental mind, vital mind, physical mind. This triple supermind which created triple svar, which projected itself into triple heaven, which resulted in triple vital and triple physical, is the same movement of the force. And cannot be realized, the supramental consciousness cannot be directly realized until that physical is fully prepared. This is the dynamic truth which was lost later in post-Vedic literature. Because it was too difficult to do it. Now, I just introduced you briefly into this Vedic vision for you to see, for our linguistic purposes, of these three, triple three levels of this speech. Yes, it's exactly about the same thing. So if we could now see what it means in terms of levels of consciousness, the meaning of structure, and meaning of expression. These are meanings. This is one meaning which is triple in its characteristic. There is proper meaning, there is meaning which will be created in structure, held by structure, expressed by structure, and there is meaning of expression. This is one meaning but has triple characteristic. So pashyanti vak, paravak expressed as pashyanti vak, intention as such, icha, meaning of meaning. Meaning of structure, pashyanti, the intention projects itself within madhyama, within the structure. And meaning of expression, pashyanti, the intention projects itself within vaikari, speech. Seeking its own expression as a poetic or any other expression, artistic. Madhyamavak is about structure. Structure of meaning is the highest level, that what we call mental vital in our metaphysical approach. Vakya supporta, the disclosure of intention in the text, in the sentence. The structure is composed in such a way that it can hold the meaning and it can disclose the meaning. I don't want you to go into every single difficulty of this formulation because it requires dwelling. I will leave you with this text for you to see if you want to see. And the most important and difficult definition would be of vaikari vak, the expression of meaning. Vaikari expresses the intention of pashyanti in the meaningful way, selecting sound expression suiting for it. An expression of structure, vaikari expresses madhyama as prakrita dhvani, articulated sound, or universal sounds, as we were talking, that we listen to sphota and not to the sound as such. An expression of expression, vaikari expresses itself as vaikrita dhvani, natural sound. Now, the whole interesting thing for me as a linguist was to discover that this expression of meaning is something which is lacking in the Western linguistics. So it is this expression of meaning, number 7, through sound, which was denied by Patanjali when he spoke about those phonemes, supa, kupa, and yupa. And all the following linguists, and finally by Saussure, defining the phoneme as having differentiating significance only. That means expression of structure is there, but there is no expression of meaning in phoneme. Phoneme itself is expressive of structure, but not of meaning. Differentiating significance is an articulated sound in the mind, prakrita dhvani. That's what we are hearing. We're hearing a, but not a which I pronounced, but a we have in our universal perception of sport. So that differentiating significance is an articulated sound in the mind, prakrita dhvani, is in our scheme the expression of structure of the sound, number 8. And the sound as such is the expression of sound. Number 9. That's what sounds my Russian English accent, which sounds out. It is because of pashyanti being present in the expression of meaning, number 7, as the unifying presence of paravak, that the sound is beyond any articulatory definition. It is not phoneme yet, but a meaningful phonic representation of paravak. I'm not sure this is clear, but I want to say it anyhow, for the sake of the course.
So phoneme
before it takes shape of the phoneme by the structure, it has its own color, its own vibration, its own way of articulating it in our apparatus. And here we were trying to do this exercise, you remember, when we were examining these different sounds and trying to move from A to E and U, and if we move slowly and see what happens to us psychologically, if I move from A, A, as Sri Aurobindo defines as undifferentiated sound, significant of undifferentiated existence, because it has no articulation, there is no effort, only vibration of cords, vocal cords. Then if I move my tongue to the palate, E, yes, expression is a little bit of that kind. E is the sound which I press with my tongue to the palate. I experience some change. What would be that change? Do you have some ideas? We can speculate this time.
In the English word itself, intensity, there is a kind of...
Intensity is a good word, yes. You wanted to say something, I didn't have time for it.
No, it just struck me that when we talk about meaning in the Western society, meaning is in the finite past and not in the spirit. So if the meaning, the truth, is in the spirit, we have lost meaning in the Western language. We won't have it there.
Yes, it's that. Exactly. You would not have it there. You would have a structure, yes. You would have everything but meaning.
And this structure, we are basing our life on this structure of society, of life, of what we can structure with Buddhism or mind. And if I come to the Eastern society, I find the meaning in the spirit as the basis of society.
And no structure.
And speech.
Yes, it's different. Right.
And this means that this dynamic dynamism, you talk about this, the union, or this, the heaven and earth meet. The dynamism that is going on is the formulation of the divine as individual in the physical, in the downward movement, and it would be the formation of the divine in the upward movement.
This is a sociological look, it's quite interesting, on the same structure, social look. Very, very true. It would be the same truth in whatever look you take. You cannot avoid it. It's fundamentally true. So this particular color of articulation was lost because in the Western tradition there was no clear vision how we articulate sounds. It was lost with Greek alphabet. When Greeks introduced alphabet, it disappeared from the stage. We had no notion of how sounds are articulated in a systematic way with a change of meaning. Psychological state. When we articulate certain sounds, We have certain psychological states. This was completely lost. But when Sanskrit scholars came to India, first Sanskrit scholars at the end of 18th century, and started to collect data, first what they discovered was Sanskrit language, and that was a surprise. First meaningful alphabet. Not A, B, C, D, E, F, G, which nobody knows what it means, because there is no meaning in it, in Greek at least. But kakha gaghana, chacha jajhanya, tatha dadhana, tatha dadhana, papha babhama. All possible articulations on all possible levels of articulation gathered in groups, in meaningful groups. From the discovery of Sanskrit, we have all other sciences coming in 19th century. We have comparative philology, comparative mythology, history, Indo-European languages and mythology and history and sociology, everything. In every aspect of humanities we have a change with the discovery of Sanskrit language. Now it's forgotten, we don't remember it anymore. But that time it was a great movement in the philosophy, in linguistics, everywhere, in 19th century.
Now the Western approach would be that these sounds exist because that is the structure of the physical apparatus of the human being.
Yes.
And therefore these sounds exist.
Yeah.
While the medical approach would be that these sounds existed before even the world was created, and that actually evolution is just bound to create a being which will be able to, if that being is fully manifested, to reproduce each of these eternal sounds.
Very true. The point is here that we are misled by the outer expression, and we think about these sounds in outer way of sounding, as dhvani, expression of expression. And we think that, how come, ah, and if I would have different vocal cords and it would sound like, would it be the same ah? Yes, it would be the same ah. If I would have an apparatus of dolphin or whale, I would sound different ah. The point is that my apparatus was built according to the need of that particular expression, of that particular expression, of that psychological state, of that color of meaning, which predominates every expression and not visible. It's like a color. When you paint the painting, you see the painting, you don't see colors. You see the forest, the ocean, the sun. You don't see those elementary colors which went into that expression. That is how, it's a fundamental thing.
Focus?
Yes.
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 If the sounds were there, you have to compare human beings which produce the sounds.
Yes.
Where is the eye and where is the hand?
There somewhere. Who is the first? Hang or an egg? Cock is the first. The third option. The cock got lost somewhere on the way, so we're asking about hen and egg, but we don't see that the cock was there somewhere. So I do not know really now what to tell you. I know that it is obviously there, that sound, and I can feel it, and poets can feel it very strongly. And the choice between different synonyms, you can choose, and if you say, I was using this example, huge ocean, and big ocean and great ocean, these are three different oceans in our perception. If we are more subtle, we feel what it means, huge ocean or immense. Though for the concept, for the structure, it would mean the same thing, because they are synonyms. And for the translators, it would be just a preference of choice. Yeah? But for the one who is using language, these are different choices of articulating the meaning. And in poetry, they are crucial. They are fundamental. We know very little about it. Nearly nothing. Close to nothing.
And what is the other point? That is, except that the meaning is, it's also vibration, it has a special warmth or another quietness and living energy in, compared to great ocean. Great ocean is short, it's just...
Big. Big is more solid, immense is as huge, has depth. Immense doesn't have depth, it has a space, a stretch of space. How do we know this? How do I know this? And how could you really confirm this with me? Through what such means we can really communicate about these subtle matters? It is because Brihaspati's word is still living within us. That color is still having something in us because we articulate it. The sphota is a structure, but one side of sphota, the meaning of it, is the color, the meaningful vibration which is forcing us to experience it. So this is the whole presentation up to the end of our course on Tantra. So here we end our presentation on Tantra, and there will be second part on linguistics, Western linguistics. We will start from Greeks and we will move up to modern times.
That's a short second half.
Four lectures. I think it's more than enough. I don't have more material for you in this introductory. Now, there are more things here which are very interesting to speak about, how Sri Aurobindo saw in Sanskrit this possibility of real science of language, how he calls it. Yes? He says, the true method of science, says Sri Aurobindo, is to go back to its origins, the embryology, the elements and more obscure processes of things. From the obvious, only the obvious and superficial results. That's where we are all stuck in the Western approach. The profundities of things, their real truth, can best be discovered by penetration into the hidden things that the surface of phenomena conceals, into that past development of which the finished forms present only secret and dispersed indications, or into the possibilities from which the actualities we see are only a narrow selection. The similar method applied to the earlier forms of human speech can alone give us a real science of language. Law and process must have governed the origins and developments of language. Given the necessary clue and sufficient data, they must be discoverable. It seems to me that in the Sanskrit language, the clue can be found. The data lie ready for investigation. We can find an equal regularity, an equal reign of fixed process on the psychological side in the determining of the relation of particular sense to particular sound. These are revolutionary statements. Nobody dares even to think that we can at all find that meaning of sound through our psychological processes. Such a program of research is of the highest possible aim, to recover and recreate the meaning of the word in its highest sense as Shabda Brahman, Uvakyapadiya, or Paravak of the Tantra. So this is the end of our tantric research. And here I would welcome your comments, questions, discussions, anything on this part. It was a long part, 10 times we met, 10 sessions we went through. So it's the end of it.
Now one question, for instance, if we take this line that, for instance, the deep sound originally in the Aryan speech had a cutting, crunching, or whatever, or a connotation, something like this, then Sri Aurobindo somewhere gives us a long list of words which then came from that. But as anybody or someone like you does research whether we find the same thing in a completely different continent, like for instance in African languages or in South American Mayan languages, whether there also people follow the same original process. Because we know well about the so-called Indo-Aryan languages, but when we go in another part of the world, what do we find there?
So the question is about, is it really objectively regular
and
universal for any people in the world speaking so many different languages? How can we really justify it? Languages are so different. That's what Saussure said. If you compare different languages, we clearly see that sound has nothing to do with meaning. It's completely conventional and arbitrary in some way. But it's again the same mistake what Patanjali made. He didn't look for root sounds. They just compared the surface. This outer phenomenon, the expression of expression. They compared the expression of expression, which it took a contextual meaning in historical time of the building up of particular meaning. If I take a meaning of root U, and from it I will build you the whole scheme in Sanskrit language, you will see all derivations, and you will see how these meanings were derived from this original one simple meaning. We can even try it now and see how the scheme grows, how meaning, the general meaning, is maintained in particular contextual meanings, and how it is changed by adding certain things, and how it, by application, it can change at all into another meaning. You can see the derivation. And then we will understand that such question, if we really want to know and go deep into it, then we can find the answer. But if we want to judge it on the surface, as it was done, then we will not find any answer. So if I will switch off this, maybe to right.
Now we can see
an interesting thing. If I take for you Sri Aurobindo's definitions of the sounds, I take root U, which, very simple root, consists of two vowels, E and U. E vowel has meaning of that tendency to break, as Sri Aurobindo defines it, as a tension to break and to occupy the space. It is directional, and you can feel it when you make this E sound, that it is intentional, it is forceful, it is like a spear flying to the target. And U is occupant of the space, has duality within itself, and firmly occupant of the space, holding the space. Now, who has a duality, this has oneness, and you will have such a figure like this. on one side oneness, on another open duality, and this root has two meanings in the dictionary you will find, and will be surprised to read. One is to unite, which is very valuable, to unite, and other is to divide. The same figure has two meanings. How you apply it? Two in one can be applied as unity, when I look from unity, or if I look from diversity towards unity, uniting, from unity towards diversity, dividing. Therefore, such, like I will take another form, weave. To weave, weave already, you can see both there, these two meanings are there. There is a space, there is a tendency. We as a prefix has two meanings, to hold two things together. And Vishnu, most difficult etymology, suffix snu, of the doer, the one who does we. Vishnu is described in Taittiriya Aranyaka as the one who holds by the power of Vayu, to heaven and earth, steadily. It is he, by the power of Vishnu, he is dividing and holding separately too. He is holding two, heaven and earth, in oneness. He is in the Trinity in that position also, to hold the different things in oneness. From here we have Vijnana as a supermind, which holds the oneness of things, comprehensive consciousness. Now, from this U, if we move to different roots, we will get to huge, to yoke, yoke, close etymology, from the same, I'm sure that it's very close. Then we have the yudh, to fight. Now, notice these things. Huge, to unite, to yoke. From here we have many derivations. Huge, to fight, yupa, from the sacrificial pose to which the sacrificial animal is tied. This duality. Yeah? So you will find the same. These roots give enormous, this maybe not this, number of other words, from which here is yoga. And if you look into the Manuel Williams dictionary, you will find 150 meanings of yoga listed there. And if I read to you, you will be surprised just to look into that, what it may mean, what this thing can mean. It can mean anything. Because this device, universally applied, can give any contextual meaning. So where should we go in search for that particular deeper meaning, how people used their languages afterwards, how they deviated from these sounds more and more into the contextual meaning applied later in an artificial way because they lost the system of etymons and reference to the sound meaning. It is only in Sanskrit that the reference to the sound meaning is maintained. Now, wherever I will meet these sounds, they will have the same color in the meaning of the root. They will not change. Do you understand? The meaning of E, whatever root I take, will have that color, that particular influence, and will appear in contextual application. This is something unique. You don't have such languages anymore. And if you open Sanskrit dictionary and go word by word, how words are listed, you will say, you will read translations, and you will see the translations, or English translations, they will change gradually. They will not jump. They will not suddenly change into unexpected meaning. You will see the gradation of change of meaning in the dictionary. What does it say to you? Just open English dictionary and see what happens. Every word is another meaning, altogether out of the blue. And you can't really connect them. What are they in common together? They have nothing in common. Here there is a gradation, slow, because sound is changing slowly, adding something, yes? Then the meaning is changing also accordingly.
What is interesting, because we're looking at it in our Sanskrit class, is that certain root sounds have influenced the Indo-European languages to the point that we see that sound recur in all the words that have that or imply that root meaning. And we were looking at the word stop. And then we looked at so many English words which had that
stuff,
stable,
all of them.
Stone. So even if the English are unaware of the root meaning, it's in their language.
Yeah.
And they happen to speak it without knowing where the meaning
certain roots like sati and others, yes, they are very strong. Have strong formations and they survived, but certain disappeared because of other things.
It might be that the original meanings have not in fact been lost at all. The only thing that's been lost is an awareness of the connections.
This is exactly what it is. It's what it is. Sri Aurobindo gave us a scheme in his Origins of Aryan Speech, where he deals with those roots which could have been used there. He gives us a scheme like a table of Mendeleev of the chemical. He says all these are possibilities and all these are meanings. Now, from this particular set, we have these active and known to us, but it doesn't mean that those others cannot be found or cannot be recreated. And here we have another option for it.
So this seems to be a principle of structure, in fact, that it can be utilized by a vast range of formations.
Right.
The structure itself is just a tool.
Right. The problem is here, one problem. We cannot rely fully on the structure. Structure is only to hold for us something which we have to discover. And that, if we don't discover structure, will not help. Now, what Sri Aurobindo says, he says that there are 50 original sounds in the alphabet, Sanskrit alphabet, which can communicate or can create certain meanings, yes? But with every one of them, you can arrive at every one's meaning, if you want. And I can show you how it is done. Once you see that, there will be no more question how these meanings appeared. Because if you take all the words, for example, for light used in Sanskrit language, you will see that they are derived from different roots. Yes, I have to end. But this is the beauty of the system. That's first of all, it's regular, it's universal. You can arrive at any contextual meaning, yes? You can call this thing by whatever way you want, whatever you want to bring into this meaning. It can be pithika, supporting thing, it can be flat thing, palakam, it can be white, wooden stand for computer, it can be any descriptory or any derived from the root meaning this particular standing thing in front. And it will be clear what it means. Now, once it is fixed by the mind as a conventional table, you don't have another word for it. It's only a table. There is no other word. Mind fixes it. It's an economy of mind, structured, conventionalizes this thing, and we cannot really deviate. So, unfortunately, our time is off. Otherwise, I would show you.
Can you do that next time? Can you start next time?
I can show you, yes. The meanings, how they are.
Yeah, that would be an interesting start to the
how you can come from one meaning to any other particular contextual meaning. And that we can take even yoga and see, just open the dictionary and you will be surprised in trying to understand how this device could be really utilized to arrive at that contextual meaning. That would be it. So we finished for now, for today. Thank you very much. Let us finish with a minute of silence.